Hello and welcome, listeners, to ION EDI, the anti-racism podcast where we unpack equity, diversity, and inclusion. This podcast is recorded on the unceded traditional territory of the Sequimic people. I am grateful for the opportunity to live, learn, and play on their lands.
Hi, Ronnie. I'm so happy to have you on today. I've always wanted to speak with you one-on-one. It's just you always bring a lot of knowledge to conversations around EDI. And I'm just really excited to hear what you have to say today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. So good morning or afternoon. I am Rani Srivastava. I am presently the Dean of Nursing at Thompson Rivers University. And I think it's interesting, you know, how does one introduce oneself? So I, from a personal perspective, I would consider myself a first generation immigrant to Canada, probably 1.5 generations because I was in high school when we came, or junior high. So in many ways, my formative years have been spent here growing up, coming up with my own identity, navigating as a parent, with my own children. But at the same time, I think I was fortunate because I was about, you know, sort of early adolescent when I came, I had a really good sense of my country of origin, my family, so I come from India. And so that those ties were very strong with me, both from a culture and a language perspective. And I think that has served me really well over the years. So that's who I am.
You and I share that in common, that I don't quite understand like the generations for a second, but essentially I was a baby when I came here. So I don't know what that, I think it's first generation. Sorry, I really don't understand the terminologies, but I find it really interesting when people come at a young age and then you have to kind of adjust into a new society, but then you also have that pressure of not adjusting too much so that you lose yourself. And I just find that to be a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I think it really varies from individual to individual and your own, I think the age and the context in which you are in, both you were in the country of origin and here. So I watched it with me and I think, you know, you don't, I mean, I've reflected backwards. So, mm-hmm. You know, memory is always what it is. And I think you instinctively learn. There are ways we did things in India that were very natural to me. There are ways I learned to do things here in North America that were a little bit different. But when you come, you have to learn. And mm-hmm. That's important. And then I think because, you know, when you socialize with the Indian community, you could go back to your ways of being that felt comfortable. But even those were changed because the community here was much more diverse from a subcontinent that it would have been what I would have been in my own family. And then I watched it in my kids. It was funny because they were born here, but I think it's the home environment and the socialization. So, you know, even when they were early on, if the phone rang, you know, you could kind of tell those were the days of before call display, kind of had to answer the phone to figure out who was calling. And after the phone with their usual, you know, hello. And then depending on who they heard at the other end, the rest of the conversation switched both their, how they greeted. So it would either be, oh, hi, auntie. Hello, auntie. Or yes, how can I help? You know, it was just, and I just watched it. It was just, and the kids, I think, are very adaptable and they're very resilient. And you kind of just switch with the flow, however it's going. And then that sets the stage for how the rest of the conversation unfolds, right? From a greeting to a communicating respect to your relationship and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I actually didn't know that there was a term for this until I think I was listening to another podcast actually called Code Switch. And that's how I found out that, oh, there's a word for this like persona shift that we do. And I definitely see it in myself, even if I'm on campus and I see somebody and it's like my demeanor just changes. And it's like, oh, hello, auntie. Hello, uncle. How are you doing today? Yeah. How is auntie doing? How's uncle doing? How's everybody doing? Oh yeah, for sure. I'll say hi for you. It's like this whole shift in yourself and how you express yourself. And I think my voice kind of changes a bit too. But I find that interesting, especially in terms of transitioning to university when students have lived in an environment for their whole lives. Even like myself during high school, I didn't really socialize with people much outside of school. I was very studious. So there wasn't really an exposure to that extent of the outside world and what it's like to move around in it until university, where you really have no option but to be immersed in the world. And I've been thinking a lot about that transition for other students, especially children of immigrants who in my experience at least, you don't really understand the system. You kind of have to learn as you go, and that already puts you at a disadvantage. And it's kind of this double disadvantage of feeling alienated sometimes, and then also having to go about and learn everything yourself.
And it's hard. I understand that. I don't know that I can reflect on it from an experiential perspective. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time in my career thinking about it and talking about it and writing about it, actually. Mm-hmm. And I watched it with my kids, because I think post-secondary is such an important time. I mean, if you think about it from a developmental perspective, mm-hmm. right, where you are, you know, you're sort of late adolescent, early adulthood, depending on your age and your maturity. So you're trying to discover who you are and what you are. And even in a very homogenous society, this is the time when children come to their own, right? You start to form your own notions of adulthood and personhood and all of those kinds of things. And then you add the cultural piece to it. Mm-hmm. And I think it just makes it even more complex. What is okay? And even with how do you establish relationships in a different context, even with people who may be coming from your community, your ethnocultural community, right? Or your racial community, is that the rules aren't clear anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. And I know that. And I think it's such an important time to really encourage people to explore their sense of who they are, where they're coming from, and allow them the freedom to discover something new, who they can be. I watched it with my kids, and as a parent, it was really hard. There's that boundary, and I'm looking at it both personally and professionally. And so I think my kids have taught me a lot as they've grown up with this.
I think there's also that piece about, especially when you're in post-secondary and you're trying to learn about who exactly you are, and you're trying to fit into the world, especially when you're in a profession like nursing, you have that, for us, an added dimension of fitting into that role of professional and professionalism. And I think there can be a little bit of a barrier when people see you really superficially as your skin color first, or for me, like your hijab first. And that's like the label that they put on you first, and then you kind of have to adjust with it. Reflecting on what you're saying is that a lot of people haven't quite formed their cultural identity and how they fit into the world properly yet. And I think that just added layer of baggage is something that people don't understand when they're having these conversations with their students, or when their students are struggling with something. And that's just been something that I've been really thinking about recently.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And I think that some of the work that I've enjoyed most and my best conversations have been with people. And, you know, it's interesting. Identity changes at every stage of life, right? So I think we're talking about the transition from, you know, high school, where you are much more tied to your own family and your own community, to university, for example. Often people will either leave home, or even if you're still living at home, your world changes, your schedule changes. I negotiated that when one of my kids went away from university in one state, and we had to figure out how to reorganize our relationship, because as she's growing and changing with her own developmental needs, as her school needs, as her demands, etc. But what I was going to say is that I think that happens at different stages of life, because I can think back to when I first, you know, kind of became a parent. And then as my kids have grown up, they're adults, as they have grown up through different stages of life, what does it mean to parent children who are clearly, they are Canadian and yet they're not? And at least the world doesn't always see them that way. And so how do I support them in kindergarten, and what happens in junior high, and what happens in high school? And so I've watched that change. And so I think that whole sense of, as you're saying, you know, trying to navigate your own cultural identity and where you fit in. I think it's really important, though, to have the space for those conversations. Right. I don't think anybody can prescribe what it ought to be, mm-hmm. but having the space for those conversations, to explore yourself, to listen to how other people have navigated it and what, you know, their thoughts on it. I found those conversations to be really helpful, both for me, and I watched it, as I said. So, you know, when I think back to my own family or friends that I've known and watched the kids grow up over time, they've changed to, and so if I just use the Indian identity, because Indian. And when I was growing up in Nova Scotia, terminology changes. The terminology there was Indo-Canadian. When I moved to Ontario, I was told the right terminology, Ronnie, is South Asian. And I'm like, who decides what the right terminology is? I kind of grew up with that Indo-Canadian identity. That's what I was exposed to. And I watched my kids. At times, they were very Canadian, and really understand a lot about the Indian culture, nor was it really valued. It was what it was. It was home. And, you know, honest to God, these parents are making me do these things and I have no idea why. But then over, as they grew and they kind of went out into the world, they kind of started to form their own. And it's interesting that shift back and forth between the Indian side of them and the Canadian side of them. And I think it's like you find a, become comfortable with who you are. And, you know, you're not, what I was going to say, not the completely Indian or not completely Canadian, and yet you are, right? So it's that, it's finding that balance between who you are and being very comfortable with it. And it isn't for anybody else to judge, to say this is too little Indian or too more, too much Indian or too little Canadian or too much Canadian, because it's all the right identity. Mm-hmm. But I think coming to that space is really hard because other people want to tell you how you should be.
Exactly. That's something that I even myself have really struggled with coming into university, or just growing up here in general. We did a lot of globe hopping, globe trotting around. We moved constantly when I was younger, like every 4 years, it would be a new city, potentially a new country. And there was, there was a lot of just reestablishing your identity. And I found that the biggest barrier to that is people's perceptions of you and what they see. And even now, as a nursing student, sometimes it makes me nervous that when I walk into a room, regardless of how qualified I am or what I may be capable of, people's first thought of me is skin color first. And I think you learn to be really vigilant of that. And sometimes I think it can hold you back. But then in other contexts, I think it can be really, you know, powerful to have that ability to switch within worlds.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it becomes, you're right, it's what's in the foreground, what's in the background, right? And so where it has helped, and I think particularly in professional worlds, you're absolutely right. I can't control what other people think or say. I can influence it, or at least I can try to influence it. So again, this is something that I've learned within myself. And again, great conversations I've had with students, with internationally educated colleagues, nurses particularly, because I've done a fair bit of work with them. And what you start to help people understand is you're absolutely right. People will judge you or will see you in the first shot. So as you said, you know, when you and I walk into the room for you, they may first see the hijab. Mm-hmm. They may first see my skin color, right? I can't change that. Mm-hmm. But what I am mindful of is to say, A, I'm not going to let that rattle me in any way. I can recognize that for some people, the reason they're reacting is, and this is what nursing has taught me. So now I kind of, you know, I can't separate me as a nurse from anything else. So nursing has taught me to be always think about patient-centered and what are people thinking and what are their needs. And so I think about if they're judging me, why are they? What's their need? And so if it's a patient and I'm going as a nurse, I'm very mindful of the fact that I'm in the power position, right? That they're the vulnerable one. So if they're judging me and they're worrying about my skin color, it's because they're scared or they're worried. So I try really hard to bring the professional part of me up front and use that to guide the interaction and not let it rattle me. As I said earlier, some days it's easier to do than others, depending on the reaction, I'll be honest. But I think that's how I've learned to navigate it, is to say, you're seeing the skin color, the hijab in the foreground and the rest of my professionalism in the background. Let me switch that. I'm going to bring the nurse of me in the foreground. And that's what you and I are going to focus on, because that's why I'm here. That's why we're in this relationship. And hopefully, it doesn't always happen, the hijab and the skin color as you develop the relationship goes into the background.
Right.
Easier said than done. But I think for me, that's how I've really learned to appreciate it. And when I start to get caught up in that, or when I'm chatting with students or colleagues who've had, you know, and it's hard because if somebody's made an overly racist statement, or even if it's overtly racist, it still hurts, right? Mm-hmm. And depending on your own resilience that day, how you handle it, how you can handle it will vary. But I always try to remember. So I think that's the part that those of us who come with those identities need to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part that others need to understand, is to say that there are days I can handle it and there are days I'm going to need help with a peer. To say, you know, how can I support you in navigating this relationship? Because just recognizing, as you've said, it's there. You can't pretend it's not there. So let's figure out how we can not have it in a negative way and just really work to supporting it in a positive way, right? I can tell you a funny example of this. So as a nurse, I think it was, you know, probably I think I was graduated, I was working, and I worked a lot with the elderly patients. And so I was always taught to not use first names for elderly people. I never did. And when I came to university, it was really hard for me to start calling some of my professors by their first name. It was easier to do in university. And then I'm with the patient, and some of the patients, there was one patient in particular, and I'm talking like, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago now, I can still see his face. And he just reminded me of my grandfather. He just looked similar. His mannerisms were similar. And, you know, you're taught professionally, I know, always call people by the name they prefer. So he always said, Ronnie, call me. And I said, yeah. And I always called him Mr. Whatever. I can't remember his last name now. And so finally, by the third interaction, he said, I told you to call me John. And I said, you know what? I know you did. And I'm sorry. I'm really trying. I know it's important. But I have to tell you, I'm struggling because you just remind me so much of my grandfather. And in my culture, we just don't use first names like that, you know, for any elderly people. And so I said, I'm having difficulty. So please forgive me if I'm not able to. I will get there. I'm trying really hard. But that's why I haven't been able to, why I'm struggling with it. And I think that interaction just really helped so much because he said, oh, well, in that case, you call me Mr. Such and Such. And I think that this is where it becomes important to be able to be comfortable with it. We had developed a relationship that I could share it and not to judge people by behavior, but go to that intent and that meaning. And when I shared that with him, he said, oh, that's totally fine. You can call me Mr. Such and Such, because he was trying to communicate that we had a good relationship. He didn't want the formality. And I think when he understood that it wasn't the formality, in fact, it was respect, and it was respect tied to something more intimate and personal for me, right? He just went totally, oh, that's totally fine. And then every time I call him Mr. Sanjay, he goes, I remind her of her grandfather, you know? You know what? It could have gone so badly, but it didn't, right? It went really well. And it taught me a lot about, as a nurse, it was okay for me to say, I hear you, but that was, it was my cultural identity, right? It's me. And so I have learned with that is to say, recognizing that how is it that I am behaving in certain ways that other people may be interpreting in a way that is not what I intend, right?
Mm-hmm. Or that is a little bit foreign to them.
Yeah.
Which I think when people view things as unusual or foreign, that kind of, I think that scares people really easily, like you said earlier. And you know, it's that fear of others that really, you know, that I think is the biggest barrier to having proper relationships between cultures and even countries, is just the fact that people are scared of things that aren't familiar to them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that fear comes at multiple levels, right? So one is the fear, I mean, we're socialized, right? Distrust things that aren't familiar. And especially as the world has gotten weirder and weirder with, you know, wars and terrorism and this and that, if you don't recognize it, if it's not familiar, you treat it with caution. That's, I mean, I taught my own kids that, safety first, right? But somehow you have to kind of not internalize that in a way that you apply it to everybody. So this is where the you know, you have to mediate that. The other fear that comes is, so I think it's also for many people I watched, and I think particularly in healthcare, as I watched my colleagues, my students, myself, it's also the fear of saying the wrong thing, right? So often, and you know, when you try something really hard not to do, it kind of just goes, just go well most often, like they see the hijab and they don't really want to comment on it. So, you know, in your head, you're having this scenario about, I don't want to comment on the hijab. I don't want to comment on the hijab. I don't want to comment on the hijab. But then what are you seeing? It's the hijab. Yeah. I think it's that piece, and you kind of have to help people recognize this to say, you know, how do we get to that stage where we can have some respectful conversations and recognize that, you know, so I learned very early on navigating cultural stuff. And, you know, this is my area of cultural competence in healthcare. So yeah. I am going to make mistakes. I'm going to make, you know, that, I, oh my God, I can't make a mistake. I will make a mistake. I will say something that'll be offensive to people. Mm-hmm. I need to be really cautious and not blurt it out or just try to do my best to understand myself what it is, so I minimize the opportunity, and then just be really vigilant for, you know, miscommunication. And I know I'm going to put my foot in my mouth, and hopefully I can take it out when it's only a toe that's gone in, as opposed to my whole foot.
That's true.
You learn to be vigilant. You learn the art of humility, and, you know, you learn to apologize and say, so sometimes I'll start up with like, I don't know what to do this. I don't want to create, but I know this can be awkward. So let me just put it on the table and figure out how we're going to work together. And at other times it is about, I can't do that. That doesn't feel right. So we just let it go. But I'm just really, I'm mindful that it isn't with anybody's intention, but things can start to go awry. So let me not start judging people or coming up with, you know, blaming people, but just recognize that if something is not going the way I think it ought to, whether it's a conversation or something, then sometimes I'll just do exactly that. I'll pause it to say, hey, what, have I done something, or I don't quite know how to say it in a way that is respectful. And just like with the story I told you about John, this is my intent, and I'm sorry if it's not coming along the way I want it to. And then that creates a space for a mutual conversation. So there's no recipe, but I think those are the kinds of things that have worked, that have helped me in my career.
Have you found that as you've advanced through leadership positions, that there has been like certain like perceptions of you based on, you know, skin color, immigration status, et cetera, that have really held you back? That's really a rhetorical question because I know the answer to this, but I still do want to ask.
Yes. Can I prove it? No. Mm-hmm. But do I feel it? Yes. Have I watched it in other people? Yes. Do I probably have more data on other people because I've been in those conversations, right? So for me, I think, let me start with what you've asked. Does it hold you back? I think it holds you back at several levels. It holds you back first and foremost in your own sense of confidence and what you can even imagine for yourself. That's why I think representation is so important, because people need to be able to see people who look like them in places and in positions of power, of, you know, higher status, of leadership, because that creates a sense of possibility. So I think that's the first step for many of us. If you never see that, you don't even think it's possible. And so you unconsciously discount that. Once having a conversation about, I'd applied for a job, you know, it was a pretty senior job and I was pretty junior in my career, at least relatively. And I was shortlisted. And then they invited me for an interview like 5 months later. And I remember going to my boss then. I had moved on to a different job, but I remember saying to I was in academia at the time. And I remember saying to the dean then is to say, they've invited me for this job interview. And I think I really want to go, because not that I'm going to change the job. I love my new job that I've just taken in academia, but people like me, and I still remember this because I said, people like me don't get opportunities like that. And this is where, like, I am, you know, by now I'm probably well in my 30s. I'm, you know, I'm a professor at a university, and that's the scenario in my head. And she looked at me and she said, well, what do you mean, Ronnie, people like you? And so that kind of just, and we had a good relationship, and that got into a conversation that helped me understand a little bit about what I was feeling. But I think it's those barriers. We don't always say it out loud, even to ourselves, but we think it. Right? We think it that people like me don't get jobs like that. So I don't even go after it. I think that's one. And then I think there are others where you've said that people misunderstand or they misjudge or misinterpret. So I can certainly think about, you know, when I had the opportunity to be a director or a vice president or a chief nurse, I would be recruiting people and, you know, for some key positions. And I remember I was trying to hire for a director position, and the person, my candidate of choice, because of her track record, she's absolutely amazing, is a Black woman from Jamaica. Her family is from the Caribbean. All kinds of really interesting roots. A phenomenal person, a huge mentor to me in many ways.
I have a feeling where this is going.
But when I was looking at trying to recruit her, I had a lot of colleagues who said, well, you know, she doesn't have a track record. Because again, if I'm recruiting for a key director position, I need buy-in from my colleagues. Mm-hmm. And so I think in those conversations that you start to see where the barriers are, where the biases are, and where the interpretation people had of her and of her accomplishments or of her mannerisms or of a whole bunch of other stuff. And it was really important for me to be able to counter those, right? Because
I knew this was the best person for the job. Like, I really needed her for the job, right? And she got it eventually, and she was absolutely amazing, no question. But even that becomes a risk, because if I'm championing somebody, then that's putting me in a vulnerable position. And so I think it's layers upon layers of this, but I think it's just so important to do, to try to have those open, transparent conversations. So every time somebody championed to say, yes, but you know what, this is what I've heard. And I said, well, I don't know who you're hearing that from. This is what I know of her. She's worked with me on this project and is delivered. I know this. But it also, that whole process, as difficult as it was, also helped me understand when she did get the job, how important it was for me and others to support her to be successful.
Right.
So I think it's not any one place. It's, do you see yourself? Can you get a foot in the door? How are people going to be judging you? Because, you know you're going to be, is there some greater expectations? Because many of us would say there are higher expectations, right? You have to be twice as good to get half the credit.
Yes.
Some of that, I would say, yes, absolutely. So, and what's interesting is it doesn't shift whether you are a nursing student or a vice president of a hospital. Unfortunately, I've had to navigate those relationships in a boardroom more often than not. As I have, I just think, when you get into those positions, hopefully, I have thicker skin and more chutzpah and more experience to be able to navigate them, and more colleagues who are very supportive. None of us can do this by ourselves.
You know what? Like you just said, you have to be twice as good. I was mentioning this in another conversation about how there's this pressure for perfection and there's not enough room for failure, because there, for me at least, failure really isn't an option. What are you going to do if you don't get this nursing degree, if you don't get any degree really? And if you're not in a position of, I'm trying to find the right word, but if you're not in a position of security where you are something, you're just another immigrant that people are going to look at, even if you aren't an immigrant, you've been born here for some people, but you're just going to be looked at as a person taking advantage of the system. Or there's just so many connotations that go with that. And then there's also the pressure from families for people to perform well because they've given up something to be here, or that they've given you an opportunity that they may not have had, or even if they did have, they still had to go through a transition, put you where you are. And I think that immense pressure, especially at a younger age in universities, can have a detrimental effect on people's mental health, which people really don't realize.
It's true. It's very true. The stakes are a lot higher, right? The stakes are a lot higher, and that's where the pressure comes from. And they're higher, as you've said, at multiple levels. You're putting more pressure on yourself because, and I watched it with my nieces, my nephews, my friends' kids. Like, maybe I don't see it in the same way because I'm too close to my own kids as they were growing up. But you see it because people will put more pressure on themselves. And I've often said to them, I'm the parent. You just get to be a kid right now, or you get to be a student. But it's really hard because they see how hard their families are working. And as you've said, and they see how hard the juggling is happening, the sacrifices people are making, and the two jobs and whatever it is that they need to do, et cetera. So they see that, and kids will want to support that. So I watched kids take on more responsibility and put pressure on themselves. It also comes from families, particularly around education. And, I just finally said to my kids, I'm a South Asian parent. I'm owning it. Get used to it. We're not changing that. I'm happy to sit and explore it and talk about it. And, I will work my way through, but I have to tell you, I value it. So, but I think we as parents have to recognize that, about what that's doing to your children. So we fortunately were able to have those conversations to say, yes, it is important. However, my adding pressure isn't going to help you. We both value education. Now, what do you need? How can I help you? Where do I need to back off? What do I need to do to try to negotiate that? And then I think the other way the stakes are higher is that you're not judged as an individual.
No.
You're judged as a member of a group. And so what's interesting, when people succeed, it's always the individual. This person from this community has done so well, right? When you feel, it's like, yeah, people from this community always do well, right? And we feel that somehow you know you are carrying that. I don't know, not that anybody's ever told you that intentionally or explicitly. You've learned that you've got that burden, and it's hard. And again, so I think you're absolutely right. That pressure is there, and because the stakes are higher.
And, you know, and I see that. And those are the kinds of things I think now, you know, in this day and age where we're talking a lot about equity and diversity and inclusion, and every organization at every level is trying to look for a more diverse team, right? So whether it is, you know, my own our school of nursing, we would like to be more diverse, or whether it is, you know, the hospital leadership or wherever. And I think what's important for people to think about is how do you support that diversity? I remember once I was teaching in the University of Toronto, and somebody made a comment about, isn't it great? We had such diversity in our classrooms. And I said, I don't know, I was being very cheeky. And I said, why? Because we look pretty? Like, why is it great? If you can't tell me why you believe this diversity is great, if you can't understand what that will do to the dynamics and how you support that diversity to thrive, right? Then simply saying, let's have diversity for the sake of having diversity is actually scary, because you're setting people up, right? You're bringing people in because they look different and they sound different and they are bring different credentials. But if you don't value what they're bringing, then they're not going to be successful. And I think the good thing is in this day and age, and I think that's what's different from the last, you know, what I would have said maybe 20 years ago, I think there's greater recognition and understanding of that. That's what gives me hope and strength. Like, I think there really is greater recognition. People are recognizing. Sometimes we do not know exactly what to do or how to do it, but we're recognizing that, you know, which is, as I said, when I started my career, people valued diversity just for the sake of diversity. And I think now we're trying to understand, I kept saying, can we go to the so what of diversity? Right? And again, this is where my understanding as a nurse, so I think of everything in healthcare and nursing terms. If you think about in a hospital, why is it that we value a team? You know, you want a doctor, you want a nurse, you want a physio, you want an OT, you want a social worker, right? Because we know they all bring something very different, but together is how we get at a much more holistic care. We get at expertise that, you know, in depth that some people may not have. And so in smaller centers where you don't have access to a lot of the team members, or when we didn't have access, we didn't see such great outcomes, right? So for me, that's what's carried over, that kind of thinking to the diversity, is to say, when we have people who think differently, that's great. We have to figure out a way how to bring that thinking out. That will lead to better decisions. That will lead to more alternatives for us to choose from. But getting there will take a little bit longer, maybe, right? It'll you have to work harder at it. And so I think there's recognition that that's what we have to do. I think we all continuously get stuck on how. There's no magic formula. There's no recipe book or algorithm that says first do this, then do this, then do this. And I think that's where we get stuck. And that's why some of these principles of really understanding equity, or what does it actually mean? You know, when we talk about inclusion is important, or a sense of belonging is important. I think digging a little bit deeper through reflection, through conversation about what does that mean? And, you know, I would often say, so what does it look like? If we said we were an inclusive space, what would that look like? How would we feel? How would we know that we've achieved that, right? And I think the good news is we're having those conversations. At least some of us are, and I think that's what we need. I think we need more of those.
You just made me think a little bit. When I start listening to deeply, my mind gets very involved in what the person's saying, and I forget to think of what I'm going to say next. But I would like to speak a little bit about your book, actually, because you speak of cultural safety, cultural competence, and I find your perspective to be quite interesting in the fact that how you separate individuals and cultures and, you know, kind of that nurse idea of person, not diagnosis, like person first ideas. And so I'd love if you could speak a little bit more on like the cultural competency, safety, dynamic difference.
So I come at the world through cultural competence initially, and then I've learned a lot more about cultural safety. And I think there are different, and I talk about this in the book. So my book is The Healthcare Professional's Guide to Clinical Cultural Competence. So again, everything healthcare, that's the world I know. And again, even the language of cultural competence, a lot of people don't like competence because they think competence means expertise, and it doesn't. I come at competence as a nurse or as a professional. So, you know, we're trying to educate students like yourself to be competent nurses. That doesn't mean when you graduate, will you be competent as a beginning practitioner? I fully expect so. You'll have to be, or we can't graduate you, right? But do you have lots to learn? Yes. Competence to me is having sufficient knowledge, skill, and judgment to, you know, navigate the situation in front of you. And sometimes it means recognizing, I'm out of my depth, I need expertise, I need more help, etc. So competence is not an end point for me. It is a
baseline.
Yeah, it's a baseline. Thank you. Very nicely said, right? And that's what I look at as cultural competence. It's a baseline. You need to understand. And so that's sort of where the framework evolved. When I started to understand that you need to understand culture and what does culture mean and how it impacts on health, people, life, thinking, all of the above, right? You need to understand what is the knowledge that you need to have. There is an element of knowledge when you think about competence. And then you think about how do you translate that knowledge and understanding into actions, whether you call them skills, whether you call them, you know, application to practice, call it whatever you like. It doesn't matter to me. But it is that whole notion of taking that understanding and translating it into action. Because if you're not translating it into action, the person that you are, you know, you're so knowledgeable, but the so what just falls apart to me. I don't need somebody who's a great thinker. I need that great thinking to also translate into
doing,
right? So I think that's for me. Cultural safety, I totally understand the paradigm it came from. It really came from that bicultural paradigm of, you know, sort of the settlers and the indigenous communities. And when you think about the colonization and the impact of colonization of totally destroying cultures, destroying language, land, anything related to your way of being. And so I see why safety is such an important paradigm to begin with. So they come at it, you know, so cultural competence to me, I came at it because I was talking about how do you navigate in a multicultural world? How do I, as a nurse, learn about culture and cultures in a way that I don't stereotype? I can't know everything about every community. I just can't. But I need enough knowledge and skill and ability to navigate that. I think cultural safety came from a more focused way of understanding about the colonizers and the indigenous peoples, whether it is in Canada or New Zealand. It actually came from New Zealand, from the Maori community, and thinking about that. But when you look deeper, so they have different origins, but when you look deeper, they're actually very similar in terms of what is being asked of us as professionals, as us persons. It is to recognize the importance of ways of being, right? And that's important. It is to recognize the need for humility, that none of us can come with this. It is to recognize that really individuals have to define what is acceptable and not acceptable, right? What we talked about earlier, where's your boundary of being who you are from the multiple cultures that you have? So I think this is where, in my head, they're very similar in terms of what we expect. They've come from different places. And I think that's the other piece, is often when people think about culture, they only think about, you know, the traditions. When we first started talking about culture, I was told, Ronnie, culture, be careful, because it's the 4Ds. It's about, people think about your diet, your dance, right? The traditions that we have, your dialect, and there's one other, dance, dialect, diet, dress. Right.
Mm-hmm.
When we initially thought about multiculturalism, we thought about multiculturalism in those four ways: the foods we eat, celebrations we have of music and dance, the way people dress, and our languages. But really, culture is about that. But you and I have just had all this conversation about the power dynamics that are associated with culture, how people judge you for who you are, what you look like. If you are feeling like you are a minority, that totally changes the dynamics of how you behave, your own sense of confidence, even your sense of hope and dreams and vision for yourself. Culture is not just about what I say patterns. So when I talk about culture, I talk about it in terms of patterns, our ways of being, right? And that diet is really important. That dress is really important. The hijab is very important to you. It's an important part of your dress. Mm-hmm. But as you've said, you are more than that. You can't just have this to say, oh, gee, you know, we really encourage and celebrate people who wear a hijab and who speak their own language. So aren't we multicultural, and have we gotten it right? But yet we still exclude you. We still exclude you from opportunities. We still judge you. And we are still, you know. So I think that's the other piece, is to recognize that culture is about our ways of being, our worldviews, our patterns. But it's also about power. What does it mean to be marginalized? What does that do to people? What does it mean to be privileged? What does that do to people? And recognizing that it's not either or, like, you know, it's the intersectionality of it that we are part of. And that, I think that was the aha moment for me. We are part of many cultures. And each one of us is unique, and yet we have lots in common with other people. So, you know, you and I can talk about, we might share a nursing culture on the South Asian subcontinent.
We are.
Yeah, right. But we have different religions. We may have, you know, at least I'm guessing, right? We have different age, different generation, right? So I think it's recognizing that whole notion of the individual and how they are situated and influenced by the groups that they are a part of, the cultures that they are a part of, and the dynamics that happen. So it was interesting. For me, those were the big ahas when we kind of got to the first edition of the book, was recognizing cultures patterns. And then the initial one edition, which was like 2007, I talked a lot about understanding the dynamics of difference. I've used stronger language this time around. It is about power and it's about privilege and it is about those things. But essentially, power and privilege are all about the dynamics of difference, right?
Yeah.
Hard part is, generally when we look at difference, we look at it in a negative way.
We do.
Which is unfortunate. Because difference, why does difference have to be negative? Why can't it be positive? Right? And sometimes we do. So I think it's that notion of recognizing that, to me, is the dynamics of difference. How do you understand that they exist? Understand that for many of us, the fears that we talked about, the lack of familiarity and all of that, can lead to a path where that dynamic, that difference, will be leading to a negative kind of a thinking, into and looking for the positive, looking for the strength, looking for the resilience, looking for the opportunity that exists. So that's really sort of the bit of an approach that I take to this work.
I think that's a really powerful approach, especially as we're trying to at least shift the ways we look at the world and the way we look at multiculturalism, because I agree with you that multiculturalism has been pretty superficial. But what kind of gives me a little bit of nervousness is when people read a book or they listen to a TED talk or, I don't know, watch a movie, a documentary, and then suddenly become experts on my experience without understanding the many layers of reasons that I am the way I am and why I look at the world I do. And I think people often forget the colonial history of the subcontinent. And so when people read a book about me or watch a documentary about me, they suddenly become experts in me, which is a little confusing. Just that sentence as a whole is a little confusing. And so what is kind of your approach of dealing with people like that? Because I struggle. I just stare at them with my eyes open, just stare. Yeah.
No, I think the approach shifts. I try to challenge respectfully, and I try to come at it from a strengths base to say, you know, it's really great that you have taken the time to learn. I think it's awesome. But one book, or even 10 books, or TED Talks, 5 movies, doesn't teach you and make you an expert at something, right? Mm-hmm. As a nurse, if all it took to become a nurse is to watch a few movies and, you know, watch ER and a few other shows, that's not what nursing is. You're not going to learn that. Right? It's the stuff that you don't see. So I try to come at it with a little bit of, you know, generosity, that if I was kind of being superficial, somebody would help me in a way that would help me learn. So I'll come at it to say, it's really great that you've taken an interest, but you know, that is a perspective, right? And the other thing I try to help people understand is that part of why it's really important to pay attention to some of the cultural competence stuff is you have to understand that when you hear something, you interpret it with your lens.
Yes.
And that's the other piece I try to encourage people to think about, is to say, that's great. You heard this TED talk and that's what you took away from it. You know, three other people with different life experiences will probably take away some very different things. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great if we actually kind of explored what we each took away from it? And so by then, our understanding would become much more broader and fuller than just what I took away. Because I'll look at it, I'll listen to something, I'll read a book, and, you know, I'll pick up on certain things, and somebody else will read a book and they'll pick up on something things. It's no different than if you watch a movie and then we come back and discuss it and think, oh, I didn't even notice that. I really like this part, right? And so I think it's trying to get at people. And I think I'm usually pretty laid back, but I get pretty firm when they start imposing it on me to say, you know what? I get to be the expert on my identity. I get to be the expert on my experience, not you. Respectfully, I'm not commenting on your expertise and experience, and you don't get to tell me how I define myself, how I describe myself, what my experience ought to be or not ought to be. And in the early days of working, even within the field, I think there was a lot of tension. I had colleagues who would say, because I did the work on cultural competence, and they came at it from a bit more of a stronger anti-racism paradigm, right? About, well, Ronnie, you only use the word culture because you want to be politically correct. And I said, I have never been told I'm usually politically correct. Not being politically correct is not something I've ever had to worry about. I'm usually not politically correct. But I said, no, I come at culture because that's what I understand. That's what resonates with me. That's my experience. You don't get to tell me how to frame my experience, right? And so it was hard though, because I think they were coming from a really good place of fighting for change and challenging and saying we need to be taking stronger action. So it was coming from a good intention and a good place, but it was actually getting to a point where I finally said to them, look, if you're not going to listen to what I have to say and just totally tell me what I'm feeling, I can't work with you because I just can't. And so I think that's the part that's really important. And I think now there's more language. There's a lot of literature out there on allyship and what does it mean to be a good ally and how do you use your privilege? And I would really encourage people to look at that content, right? Coming from a good place, you're taking the time to learn. Yay, thank you. That's awesome. That's what we need everybody to do. However, don't just go at it superficially, right? You're not going to become, you know, a rock climber or a swimmer by watching a few videos, right?
Really? So I can't just climb a mountain watching it?
Yeah, you know, when I watched the synchronized swimming and I thought, oh, that looks beautiful. There's no way I can watch 20,000 of them and I'll never be able to do that. Not from sitting on the couch and watching it. So I think it's that piece that helping people recognize to say, so happy that you're interested in it. And you know what, how can we go on this journey together? I hope that answers your question.
It does. It does. It's just, honestly, it's just a personal confusion I had that I took the opportunity to discuss. Yeah. But I see that we're kind of getting to the end of our time together. And you and I love speaking with you every time. But I do have to ask one little funny question before we end, just to end on a little humorous note while I have you here. Okay, what's your opinion on chai tea lattes?
Absolutely drives me crazy. So I have to tell you one story. I came out with chai. I'm like, what is this chai business? Chai means tea. In Hindi, chai is tea. So when they're trying to market this chai, I'm like, oh, please. So yes, no, I get incensed by it personally. What can I say? I like masala chai, but you know, the masalas will, or the spices will vary depending on what it is. But somebody has decided that this is the ingredients of a chai tea latte. And so, yeah. Do I drink it? Every once in a while I do. I'll be honest. I do. I give in. But I fight it.
Oh no, I had to ask because I asked that from anyone who's from the subcontinent, and for people not familiar with the term, we use the term Desi for people from the subcontinent. And so I have to ask every Desi person what their opinion on chai tea lattes is. For me, I have given up on having an opinion. I just kind of stare at it. Like I said, with things I can't express my outrage at it, I just stare.
It's a very interesting point, right? The deeper meaning is when dominant society discovers, quote unquote, right? So they discovered the spice chai, labeled it and marketed it. And now, and this is such an interesting concept, right? Because now that becomes the norm, mm-hmm. right? When you say, I want chai, people, that has become the norm of the chai latte is the norm of chai, which means it has a certain amount of cinnamon and a certain amount of this spice and a certain amount of that spice. Whereas for many of us, the chai was the tea, basic. Mm-hmm. You add a whole bunch of spices. So I might not put cinnamon, I like it, and I might put cloves or I might put cardamom, and that's enough. My tea only has ginger and cloves or ginger and cardamom. That's my favorite. Mm-hmm. But somehow the dominant society decided the norm. Mm-hmm. So you see, I can analyze chai tea latte and we can have a whole conversation on but anyway, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah. I've seen that happen actually with milk and turmeric, because I remember like any Desi grandmother is haldi wala dood. They put like turmeric in milk and I think a little bit of honey, I'm really not sure, and warm that up for you if you're injured anywhere. And that's become marketable now too.
Exactly. Every kid, every, as you said, every Desi kid, especially of my generation, honest to God, we ran far away from it because it tastes horrible. You need the honey to make it taste better. Yep. But now you can buy turmeric capsules. Turmeric is the thing to do.
It really is. And the thing to do for everybody is to listen to our podcast. But thank you so much, Ronnie, for being on here today. I've appreciated this conversation so much.
My pleasure. Thank you. And I think, you know, the work that you're doing in terms of raising these questions and creating a space for this conversation is absolutely awesome. So keep going.
there's, you know, that's the way we will kind of strengthen our community than ourselves. So good luck with this.
Thank you.
You can find more information about this podcast, past episodes, and mental health supports on the website i-on-edi.tierubox.ca.